strange. He had heard stories from Brother Luke. He had seen videos about things people did to one another, objects they used, props and weapons. A few times he had experienced these things himself, but he knew that in many ways he was lucky. He had been spared. The terror of what might be ahead of him was, in many ways, worse than the terror of the sex itself. At night he would imagine what he didn't know to imagine, and begin gasping with panic. His clothes, a different set of clothes now, but still not his clothes, becoming clammy with perspiration. At the end of one session, he asked Dr. Traylor if he could leave.
"Please," he said. "Please."
But Dr. Traylor said that he had given him 10 days of hospitality, and that he needed to repay those 10 days.
"And then can I go?" he asked.
But the doctor was already walking out the door. On the 6th day of his repayment, he thought of a plan. There was a second or two, just that, in which Dr. Traylor tucked the fire poker under his left arm and unbelted his pants with his right hand. If he could time it correctly, he could hit the doctor in the face with a book and try to run out. He would have to be very quick. He would have to be very agile. He scanned the books on their shelves, wishing yet again that some of them were hardcovers, not these thick bricks of paperbacks. A small one, he knew, would feel more like a slap, would be more wieldy. And so finally he chose a copy of Dubliners. It was thin enough for him to grip, pliable enough to crack against a face. He tucked it under his mattress, and then realized he didn't even need to bother with the deception. He could just leave it by his side. So he did, and waited. And then there was Dr. Traylor and the fire poker, and as he began to unbelt his pants, he sprang up and smacked the doctor as hard as he could across his face, and he heard and felt the doctor screaming and the fire poker falling to the cement floor with a clang, and the doctor's hand grabbing at his ankle. But he kicked away and stumbled up the stairs, tugging open the door, and ran. At the front door he saw a mess of locks, and he nearly sobbed, his fingers clumsy, throwing the bolts this way and that, and then he was outside and running, running faster than he ever had.
"You can do it! You can do it!"
screamed the voice in his head, encouraging for once, and then, more urgently, "Faster, faster, faster!" As he had gotten better, Dr. Traylor's meals for him had gotten smaller and smaller, which meant that he was always weak, always tired. But now he was vividly alert, and he was running, shouting for help as he did. But even as he ran and shouted, he could see that no one would hear his calls. There was no other house in sight, and although he had expected there might be trees, there weren't. Just flat, blank stretches of land, with nothing to hide behind. And then he felt how cold it was, and how things were embedding themselves into the soles of his feet. But still he ran. And then behind him he heard another pair of footsteps slapping against the pavement, and a familiar jangling noise. And he knew it was Dr. Traylor. He didn't even shout at him. He didn't even threaten. But as he turned his head to see how close the doctor was, and he was very close, just a few yards behind him, he tripped and fell, his cheek banging against the road. After he had fallen, all of his energy deserted him, a flock of birds rising noisily and swiftly flying away, and he saw that the jangling noise was Dr. Traylor's unbuckled belt, which he was sliding out from his pants and then using to beat him. And he huddled into himself as he was hit and hit and hit. All that time the doctor said nothing, and all he could hear were Dr. Traylor's breaths, his gasps from exertion as he brought the belt down harder and harder on his back, his legs, his neck. Back at the house the beating continued, and over the next days, the next weeks, he was beat more. Not regularly. He never knew when it might happen next, but often enough so that, coupled with his lack of food, he was always dizzy, He was always weak. He felt he would never have the strength to run again. As he feared, the sex also got worse, and he was made to do things that he was never able to talk about, not to anyone, not even to himself. And again, although it wasn't always terrifying, it was often enough so that he lived in a constant half-daze of fear, so that he knew he would die in Dr. Traylor's house. One night, he had a dream of himself as a man, a real adult, but he was still in the basement and waiting for Dr. Traylor, and he knew in the dream that something had happened to him, that he had lost his mind, that he was like his roommate in the home, and he woke and prayed that he might die soon. During the daytime, as he slept, he dreamed of Brother Luke, and when he woke from those dreams, he realized how much Luke had always protected him, how well he had treated him, how kind he had been to him. He had limped to the top of the wooden staircase then and thrown himself down it, and then had pulled himself up and had done it again. And then one day, 3 months later, four later, Anna would tell him that Dr. Traylor had said it was 12 weeks after he had found him at the gas station. Dr. Traylor said, "I'm tired of you. You're dirty and you disgust me, and I want you to leave." He couldn't believe it, but then he remembered to speak.
"Okay," he said. "Okay, I'll leave now."
"No," said Dr. Traylor. "You'll leave how I want you to leave." For several days, nothing happened, and he assumed that this, too, had been a lie, and he was grateful that he hadn't gotten too excited, that he was finally able to recognize a lie when he was told it. Dr. Traylor had begun to serve him his meals on a fold of the day's newspaper, and one day he looked at the date and realized it was his birthday.
"I am 15,
he announced to the quiet room, and hearing himself say those words, the hopes, the fantasies, the impossibilities that only he knew lay behind them, he was sick. But he didn't cry. His ability to not cry was his only accomplishment, the only thing he could take pride in. And then one night, Dr. Traylor came downstairs with his fire poker. "Get up," he said, and jabbed him in the back with the poker as he fumblingly climbed the stairs, falling to his knees and getting up again, and tripping again and standing again. He was prodded all the way to the front door, which was ajar, just slightly, and then outside, into the night. It was still cold and still wet, but even through his fear he could recognize that the weather was changing, that even as time had suspended itself for him, it had not for the rest of the world, in which the seasons had marched on uncaringly. He could smell the air turning green. Next to him was a bare bush with a black branch, but at its very tip, it was sprouting buboes of pale lilac, and he stared at it frantically, trying to seize a picture of it and hold it in his mind before he was poked forward. At the car, Dr. Traylor held open the trunk and jabbed him again with the fire poker, and he could hear himself making sounds like sobs, but he wasn't crying, and he climbed inside, although he was so weak that Dr. Traylor had to help him, pinching the sleeve of his shirt between his fingers so he wouldn't have to actually touch him. They drove. The trunk was clean and large, and he rolled about in it, feeling them go around corners and up hills and down hills, and then along long stretches of plain, even road. And then the car swerved left, and he was being bounced along some uneven surface, and then the car stopped. For a while, 3 minutes, he counted, nothing happened, and he listened and listened, but he could hear nothing, just his own breaths, his own heart. The trunk opened, and Dr. Traylor helped him out, plucking his shirt, and shoved him to the front of the car with the fire poker. "Stay there," he said, and he did, shivering, watching the doctor get back into the car, roll down the window, lean out at him.
Run, the doctor said. And when he stood there, frozen, you like running so much, right? So run. And Dr. Traylor started the engine, and finally, he woke and ran. They were in a field, a large, barren square of dirt, where there would in a few weeks be grass, but now there was nothing. Just patches of shallow ice that broke under his bare feet like pottery, and small white pebbles that glowed like stars. The field dipped in the middle, just slightly, and on his right was the road. He couldn't see how big the road was, only that there was one, but there were no cars passing. To his left, the field was fenced with wire, but it was farther away, and he couldn't see what lay beyond the wire. He ran, the car just behind him. At first, it actually felt good to be running, to be outdoors, to be away from that house. Even this, the ice under his feet like glass, the wind smacking against his face, the tap of the fender as it nudged against the back of his legs. Even all this was better than that house, that room with its cinder block walls, and window so small it was no window at all. He ran. Dr. Traylor followed him, and sometimes he would accelerate and he would run faster. But he couldn't run like he used to run, and he fell and fell again. Each time he fell, the car would slow, and Dr. Traylor would call out, not angrily, not even loudly, "Get up. Get up and run. Get up and run, or we're going back to the house." And he would make himself stand and run again. He ran. He didn't know then that this was the last time in his life that he would ever run. And much later, he would wonder, if I had known that, would I have been able to run faster? But of course it was an impossible question, a non-question, an axiom with no solution. He fell again and again, and on the 12th time, he was moving his mouth, trying to say something, but nothing would come out. "Get up," he heard the man say. "Get up. The next time you fall will be the last." And he got up again. By this time, he was no longer running. He was walking and stumbling. He was crawling from the car, and the car was bumping against him harder and harder. "Make this stop," he thought. "Make this stop." He remembered. Who had told him this? One of the brothers, but which one? A story of a piteous little boy. A boy, he had been told, in much worse circumstances than he was in. Who, after being so good for so long, another way in which he and the boy had been different, prayed one night to God to take him. "I'm ready," the boy said in the story. "I'm ready." And an angel, terrible and golden-winged, with eyes that burned with fire, appeared and wrapped his wings around the boy, and the boy turned to cinders and was gone, released from this world. "I'm ready," he said. "I'm ready." And he waited for the angel with his awful, fearsome beauty to come save him. The last time he fell, he couldn't get up again. "Get up!" he heard Dr. Traylor yell. "Get up!" But he couldn't. And then he heard the engine start again, and he felt the headlights coming toward him, two streams of fire like the angel's eyes. And he turned his head to the side and waited. And the car came toward him and then over him, and it was done. And that was the end. After that, he became an adult. As he lay in the hospital, Anna sitting by his side, he made promises to himself. He evaluated the mistakes he had made. He never had known whom to trust. He had followed anyone who had shown him any kindness. After, though, he decided that he would change this. No longer would he trust people so quickly. No longer would he have sex. No longer would he expect to be saved. "It'll never be this bad," Anna used to say to him in the hospital. "Things'll never be this bad again. and although he knew she meant the pain, he also liked to think she meant his life in general. That with every year, things would get better. And she had been right. Things did get better. And Brother Luke had been right as well. Because when he was 16, his life changed. A year after Dr. Traylor, he was in the college he had dreamed of. With every day he didn't have sex, he was becoming cleaner and cleaner. His life became more improbable by the year. Every year his own good fortunes multiplied and intensified, and he was astonished again and again by the things and generosities that were bequeathed to him, by the people who entered his life, people so different from the people he had known that they seemed to be another species altogether. How, after all, could Dr. Traylor and Willem both be named the same sort of being? How could Father Gabriel and Andy? How could Brother Luke and Harold? Did what existed in the first group also exist in the second? And if so, how had that second group chosen otherwise? How had they chosen what to become? Things had not just corrected themselves, they had reversed themselves, to an almost absurd degree. He had gone from nothing to an embarrassing bounty. He would remember then Harold's claim that life compensated for its losses, and he would realize the truth of that, although sometimes it would seem like life had not just compensated for itself, but had done so extravagantly, as if his very life was begging him to forgive it, as if it were piling riches upon him, smothering him in all things beautiful and wonderful and hoped for, so he wouldn't resent it, so he would allow it to keep moving him forward. And so, as the years went by, he broke his promises to himself again and again. He did end up following people who were kind to him. He did trust people again. He did have sex again. He did hope to be saved. And he was right to do so. Not every time, of course, but most of the time. He ignored what the past had taught him, and more often than he should have been, he was rewarded for it. He regretted none of it, not even the sex, because he had had it with hope, and to make someone else happy, someone who had given him everything. One night, shortly after he and Willem had become a couple, they had been at a dinner party at Richards, a raucous, casual affair of just people they loved and people they liked. J.B. and Malcolm and Black Henry Young and Asian Henry Young and Phaedra and Ali and all of their boyfriends and girlfriends, their husbands and wives. He was in the kitchen helping Richard prepare dessert, and J.B. came in. He was a little drunk, and put his arm around his neck and kissed him on the cheek. "Well, Judy," he said, "you really ended up with it all in the end, didn't you? The career, the money, the apartment, the man. How'd you get so lucky?" J.B. had grinned at him, and he had grinned back. He was glad Willem wasn't there to overhear that comment, because he knew Willem would get testy at what he saw as J.B.'s jealousy, at his conviction that everyone else had, and had had, life easier than he did, that he, Jude, was blessed in a way that no one else was. But he didn't see it like this. He knew it was in part J.B.'s way of being ironic, of congratulating him for fortune that they both knew was, yes, excessive, but also deeply appreciated. And if he was to be honest, he was also flattered by J.B.'s jealousy. To J.B., he wasn't a cripple who was being cosmically repaid for a lousy run. He was J.B.'s equal, someone in whom J.B. saw only the things to envy and never the things to pity. And besides, J.B. was right. How did he get so lucky? How did he end up with everything he had? He was never to know. He was always to wonder. "I don't know, J.B.," he said, handing him the first slice of cake and smiling at him. As from the dining room, he could hear Willem's voice saying something, and then a blast of laughter from everyone else, a sound of pure delight. "But you know, I've been lucky all my life.
Chapter 3. The woman's name is Claudine, and she is a friend of an acquaintance, a jewelry designer, which is something of a deviation for him, as he usually only sleeps with people in the industry, who are more accustomed to, more forgiving of temporary arrangements. She is 33, with long dark hair that lightens at its tips, and very small hands, hands like a child's, on which she wears rings that she has made, dark with gold and glinting with stones. Before they have sex, she takes them off last, as if these rings, not her underwear, are what conceal the most private parts of her. They had been sleeping together, not seeing each other because he sees no one, for almost 2 months, which again is a deviation for him, and he knows he will have to end it soon. He had told her when they had begun that it was only sex, that he was in love with someone else, and that he couldn't spend the night, not ever. And she had seemed fine with that. She had said she was fine with it anyway, and that she was in love with someone else herself. But he had seen no evidence of another man in her apartment, and whenever he texts, she is always available. Another warning sign. He will have to end it. Now he kisses her on her forehead, sits up. "I have to go," he says.
"No,"
she says.
"Stay. Just a little longer."
"I can't," he says.
5 minutes,"
she says. 5, he agrees, and lies back down. But after 5 minutes, he kisses her again on the side of the face. "I really do have to go," he tells her, and she makes a noise, one of protest and resignation, and turns over onto her side. He goes to her bathroom, showers and rinses out his mouth, comes back and kisses her again.
"I'll text you," he says,
disgusted by how he has been reduced to a vocabulary consisting almost entirely of clichés.
"Thank you for letting me come over."
At home, he walks silently through the darkened apartment, and in the bedroom he takes off his clothes, gets into bed with a groan, rolls over and wraps his arms around Jude, who wakes and turns to him.
"Willem,"
he says,
"you're home."
And Willem kisses him to cover the guilt and sorrow he always feels when he hears the relief and happiness in Jude's voice.
"Of course,"
he says. He always comes home. He has never not.
"I'm sorry it's so late."
It is a hot night, humid and still, and yet he presses against Jude as if he is trying to warm himself, threading their legs together. Tomorrow, he tells himself, he will end it with Claudine. They have never discussed it, but he knows Jude knows he is having sex with other people. He has even given Willem his permission. This was after that terrible Thanksgiving, when after years of obfuscation, Jude was revealed to him completely. The shreds of cloud that had always obscured him from view abruptly wiped away. For many days he hadn't known what to do, other than run back into therapy himself. He had called his shrink the day after Jude had made his first appointment with Dr. Lohman, and whenever he looked at Jude, scraps of his narrative would return to him, and he would study him covertly, wondering how he had gotten from where he had been to where he was, wondering how he had become the person he had when everything in his life had argued that he shouldn't be. The awe he had felt for him then, the despair and horror, was something one felt for idols, not for other humans. At least, no other humans he knew.
"I know how you feel, Willem,"
Andy had said in one of their secret conversations. "But he doesn't want you to admire him. He wants you to see him as he is. He wants you to tell him that his life, as inconceivable as it is still a life." He paused.
"Do you know what I mean?"
"I do know," he said. In the first bleary days after Jude's story, he could feel Jude being very quiet around him, as if he was trying not to call attention to himself, as if he didn't want to remind Willem of what he now knew. One night a week or so later, they were eating a muted dinner at the apartment, and Jude had said, softly,
"You can't even look at me anymore."
He had looked up then and had seen his pale, frightened face, and had dragged his chair close to Jude's and sat there, looking at him. "I'm sorry," he murmured. "I'm afraid I'm going to say something stupid." "Well," Jude said, and was quiet. "I think I turned out pretty normal, all things considered, don't you?" And Willem had heard the strain and the hope in his voice. "No," he said, and Jude winced. "I think you turned out extraordinary, all things considered or not." And finally, Jude smiled. That night they had discussed what they were going to do. "I'm afraid you're stuck with me," he began. And when he saw how relieved Jude was, he cursed himself for not making it clearer earlier that he was going to stay. Then he gathered himself, and they talked about physical matters. How far he could go, what Jude didn't want to do.
"We can do whatever you want, Willem," Jude said. "But you don't like it," he'd said. "But I owe it to you," Jude had said.
"No," he told him. "It shouldn't feel like something you owe me. And besides, you don't owe it to me." He stopped. "If it's not arousing for you, it's not for me either," he added. Although, to his shame, he did still want to have sex with Jude. He wouldn't, not anymore, not if Jude didn't want to. But it didn't mean he would be able to suddenly stop craving it.
"But you've sacrificed so much to be with me," Jude said after a silence.
"Like what?" he asked, curious.
"Normalcy," Jude said. "Social acceptability, ease of life, coffee even. I can't add sex to that list."
They had talked and talked, and he had finally managed to convince him, had managed to get Jude to define what he actually liked. It hadn't been much.
"But what are you going to do?" Jude asked him.
"Oh, I'll be fine," he said, not really knowing himself.
"You know, Willem," Jude had said, "you should obviously sleep with whomever you want. I just..."
He fumbled.
"I know this is selfish, but I just don't want to hear about it."
"It's not selfish," he said, reaching across the bed for him.
"And I wouldn't do that. Not ever."
That was 8 months ago, and in those 8 months things had gotten better. Not, Willem thought, his former version of better, in which he pretended everything was fine and ignored all inconvenient evidence or suspicions that suggested otherwise, but actually better. He could tell Jude really was more relaxed. He was less inhibited physically. He was more affectionate. And he was both of those things because he knew that Willem had released him from what he thought were his obligations. He was cutting himself far less frequently. Now he didn't need Harold or Andy to confirm for him that Jude was better. Now he knew it to be true. The only difficulty was that he did still desire Jude, and at times he had to remind himself not to go any further, that he was getting close to the boundaries of what Jude could tolerate, and he would make himself stop. In those moments he would be angry, not at Jude or even at himself. He had never felt guilty about wanting to have sex, and he didn't feel guilty about wanting to have it now, but at life, and how it had conspired to make Jude afraid of something that he had always associated with nothing but pleasure. He was careful about who he chose to sleep with. He picked people, women, really, they had almost all been women, who he either sensed or knew from previous experience were truly only interested in him for sex and were going to be discreet. Often they were confused, and he didn't blame them. "Aren't you in a relationship with a man?" they would ask, and he would tell them that he was, but that they had an open relationship. "So are you not really gay?" they would ask, and he would say, "No, not fundamentally." The younger women were more accepting of this. They'd had boyfriends, or had boyfriends, who slept with other men as well. They had slept with other women. "Oh," they'd say, and that would usually be it, if they had other concerns, other questions, they didn't ask. These younger women, actresses, makeup assistants, costume assistants, also didn't want a relationship with him. Often they didn't want a relationship at all. Sometimes the women asked him questions about Jude, how they had met, what he was like, and he had answered them and felt wistful and missed him. But he was vigilant about not letting this life intrude on his life at home. Once there had been a blind item in a gossip column, forwarded to him by Kit, that was clearly about him, and after debating whether to say something to Jude or not, he had in the end decided not to. Jude would never see the story, and there was no reason to make what Jude knew was happening in theory something he was forced to confront in reality. J.B., however, had seen the item. He supposed other people he knew had seen it as well, but J.B. was the only one to actually mention it to him, and had asked him if it was true. "I didn't know you guys had an open relationship," he said, more curious than accusatory. "Oh, yeah," he said, casually, "right from the start." It saddened him, of course, that his sex life and his home life should have to be two distinct realms, but he was old enough now to know that within every relationship was something unfulfilled and disappointing, something that had to be sought elsewhere. His friend Roman, for example, was married to a woman who, while beautiful and loyal, was famously unintelligent. She didn't understand the films Roman was in, and when you talked to her, you found yourself consciously recalibrating the velocity and complexity and content of your conversation, because she so often looked confused when the talk turned to politics, or finance, or literature, or art, or food, or architecture, or the environment. He knew that Roman was aware of this deficiency, in both Lisa and in his relationship. "Ah, well," he had once said to Willem, unprompted, "if I want a good conversation, I can talk to my friends, right?" Roman had been among the first of his friends to get married, and at the time, he had been fascinated by and disbelieving of his choice. But now he knew. You always sacrificed something. The question was what you sacrificed. He knew that to some people, J.B., Roman probably, his own sacrifice would be unthinkable. It would have been once to him as well. He thought frequently these days of a play he had done in graduate school by a beatly, plotting woman in the playwriting division who had gone on to have great success as a writer of spy movies, but who in graduate school had tried to write Pinterest dramas about unhappy married couples. If this were a movie, was about an unhappy married couple, he was a professor of classical music, she was a librettist, who lived in New York. Because the couple was in their 40s, at the time, a gray-colored land, impossibly far and unimaginably grim, they were devoid of humor and in a constant state of yearning for their younger selves, back when life had actually seemed so full of promise and hope, back when they had been romantic, back when life itself had been a romance. He had played the husband, and while he had long ago realized that it had been really an awful play, it had included lines like, "This isn't Tosca, you know. This is life." He had never forgotten the final monologue he had delivered in the second act, when the wife announces that she wants to leave, that she doesn't feel fulfilled in their marriage, that she's convinced that someone better awaits her. Seth. "But don't you understand, Amy? You're wrong. Relationships never provide you with everything. They provide you with some things. You take all the things that you want from a person, sexual chemistry, let's say, or good conversation, or financial support, or intellectual compatibility, or niceness, or loyalty, and you get to pick three of those things. Three, that's it. Maybe four, if you're very lucky. The rest you have to look for elsewhere. It's only in the movies that you find someone who gives you all of those things. But this isn't the movies. In the real world, you have to identify which three qualities you want to spend the rest of your life with, and then you look for those qualities in another person. That's real life. Don't you see it's a trap? If you keep trying to find everything, you'll wind up with nothing." Amy, crying. "So what did you pick?" Seth. "I don't know." Beat. "I don't know." At the time, he hadn't believed these words, because at the time everything really did seem possible. He was 23, and everyone was young and attractive and smart and glamorous. Everyone thought they would be friends for decades, forever. But for most people, of course, that hadn't happened. As you got older, you realized that the qualities you valued in the people you slept with or dated weren't necessarily the ones you wanted to live with or be with or plod through your days with. If you were smart, and if you were lucky, you learned this and accepted this. You figured out what was most important to you and you looked for it, and you learned to be realistic. They all chose differently. Roman had chosen beauty, sweetness, pliability. Malcolm, he thought, had chosen reliability and competence. Sophie was intimidatingly efficient, and aesthetic compatibility. And he? He had chosen friendship, conversation, kindness, intelligence. When he was in his 30s, he had looked at certain people's relationships and asked the question that had, and continued to, fuel countless dinner party conversations. What's going on there? Now, though, as an almost 48-year-old, he saw people's relationships as reflections of their keenest yet most inarticulable desires, their hopes and insecurities taking shape physically in the form of another person. Now he looked at couples, in restaurants, on the street, at parties, and wondered, why are you together? What did you identify as essential to you? What's missing in you that you want someone else to provide? He now viewed a successful relationship as one in which both people had recognized the best of what the other person had to offer and had chosen to value it as well. And perhaps not coincidentally, he also found himself doubting therapy, its promises, its premises, for the first time. He had never before questioned that therapy was, at worst, a benign treatment. When he was younger, he had even considered it a form of luxury. This right to speak about his life, essentially uninterrupted, for 50 minutes, proof that he had somehow become someone whose life deserved such lengthy consideration, such an indulgent listener. But now, he was conscious of his own impatience with what he had begun to see as the sinister pedantry of therapy, its suggestion that life was somehow reparable, that there existed a societal norm, and that the patient was being guided toward conforming to it. You seem to be holding back, Willem, said Idris, his shrink now for years, and he was quiet. Therapy, therapists, promised a rigorous lack of judgment, but wasn't that an impossibility, to talk to a person and not be judged? And yet behind every question was a nudge, one that pushed you gently but inexorably toward a recognition of some flaw, toward solving a problem you hadn't known existed. Over the years, he'd had friends who had been convinced that their childhoods were happy, that their parents were basically loving, until therapy had awakened them to the fact that they had not been, that they were not. He didn't want that to happen to him. He didn't want to be told that his contentment wasn't contentment after all, but delusion. And how do you feel about the fact that Jude doesn't ever want to have sex? Idris had asked. I don't know, he'd said. But he did know, and he said it. I wish he wanted to, for his sake. I feel sad that he's missing one of life's greatest experiences, but I think he's earned the right not to. Across from him, Idris was silent. The truth was he didn't want Idris to try to diagnose what was wrong with his relationship. He didn't want to be told how to repair it. He didn't want to try to make Jude or himself do something neither of them wanted to do because they were supposed to. Their relationship was, he felt, singular, but workable. He didn't want to be taught otherwise. He sometimes wondered if it was simple lack of creativity, his and Jude's, that had made them both think that their relationship had to include sex at all. But it had seemed then the only way to express a deeper level of feeling. The word friend was so vague, so undescriptive and unsatisfying. How could he use the same term to describe what Jude was to him that he used for India or the Henry Youngs? And so they had chosen another, more familiar form of relationship, one that hadn't worked. But now they were inventing their own type of relationship, one that wasn't officially recognized by history or immortalized in poetry or song, but which felt truer and less constraining. He didn't, however, mention his growing skepticism about therapy to Jude, because some part of him did still believe in it for people who were truly ill, and Jude, he was finally able to admit to himself, was truly ill. He knew that Jude hated going to the therapist. After the first few sessions, he had come home so quiet, so withdrawn, that Willem had to remind himself that he was making Jude go for his own good. Finally, he couldn't stand it any longer. "How's it been with Dr. Lohmann?" he asked one night, about a month after Jude had begun. Jude sighed.
"Willem," he said, "how much longer do you want me to go?"
"I don't know," he said. "I hadn't really thought about it." Jude had studied him.
"So you were thinking I'd go forever," he said.
"Well," he said, he actually had been thinking that. "Is it really so awful?" He paused. "Is it Lohmann? Should we get you someone else?"
"No, it's not Lohmann," Jude said. "It's the process itself."
He sighed, too. "Look," he said, "I know this is hard for you. I know it is, but give it a year, Jude, okay? A year. And try hard. And then we'll see." Jude had promised. And then in the spring, he had been away filming, and he and Jude had been talking one night when Jude said,
"Willem, in the interest of full disclosure, I have something I have to tell you."
"Okay," he said, gripping the phone tighter. He had been in London shooting Henry and Edith. He was playing 12 years too early and 60 pounds too thin, Kit pointed out, but who was counting, Henry James, at the beginning of his friendship with Edith Wharton. The film was actually something of a road trip movie, shot mostly in France and southern England, and he was working his way through its final scenes.
"I'm not proud of this," he heard Jude say, "but I've missed my last four sessions with Dr. Lohmann. Or rather, I've been going, but not going."
"What do you mean?" he asked.
"Well, I go," Jude said, "but then I sit outside in the car and read through the session, and then when the session's over, I drive back to the office."
He was quiet, and so was Jude, and then they both started laughing. "What are you reading?" he asked when he could finally speak again.
"On narcissism," Jude admitted,
and they both started laughing again, so hard that Willem had to sit down.
"Jude," he began at last, and Jude interrupted him. "I know, Willem," he said. "I know. I'll go back. It was stupid. I just couldn't bring myself to go in these past few times. I'm not sure why."
When he hung up, he was still smiling, and when he heard Idris's voice in his head, "And Willem, what do you think about the fact that Jude isn't going when he said he would?" He waved his hand before his face, as if fanning the words away. Jude's lying, his own self-deceptions, both, he realized, were forms of self-protection, practiced since childhood, habits that had helped them make the world into something more digestible than it sometimes was. But now Jude was trying to lie less, and he was trying to accept that there were certain things that would never conform to his idea of how life should be, no matter how intensely he hoped or pretended they might. And so, really, he knew that therapy would be of limited use to Jude. He knew Jude would keep cutting himself. He knew he would never be able to cure him. The person he loved was sick, and would always be sick, and his responsibility was not to make him better, but to make him less sick. He was never to make Idris understand this shift in perspective. Sometimes he could hardly understand it himself. That night he'd had a woman over, the deputy production designer, and as they lay there, he answered all the same questions. He explained how he had met Jude. He explained who he was, or at least the version of who he was that he had created for answers such as these.
This is a lovely space, said Isabel, and he glanced at her, a little suspiciously. J.B., upon seeing the flat, had said it looked like it had been raped by the Grand Bazaar, and Isabel, he had heard the director of photography proclaim, had excellent taste.
Really, she said, seeing his face. It's pretty.
Thanks, he said. He owned the flat, he and Jude. They had bought it only 2 months ago, when it had become evident that both of them would be doing more work in London. He had been in charge of finding something, and because it had been his responsibility, he had deliberately chosen quiet, deeply dull Marylebone, not for its sober prettiness or convenience, but because of the neighborhood's surplus of doctors.
Ah,
Jude had said, studying the directory of the building's tenants as they waited for the estate agent to show them the apartment Willem had settled on.
Look at what's downstairs from the unit, an orthopedic surgeon's clinic.
He looked at Willem, raised an eyebrow.
That's an interesting coincidence, isn't it?
He had smiled.
Isn't it?
He asked. But beneath their joking was something that neither of them had been able to discuss, not just in their relationship, but almost in their friendship as a whole. That at some point, they didn't know when, but that it would happen, Jude would get worse. What that might mean, specifically, Willem wasn't certain, but as part of his new dedication to honesty, he was trying to prepare himself, themselves, for a future he couldn't predict. For a future in which Jude might not be able to walk, might not be able to stand. And so finally, the fourth floor Harley Street space had been the only possible option. Of all the flats he had seen, this had been the one that had best approximated Green Street. A single-story apartment with large doors and wide hallways, big, square rooms, and bathrooms that could be converted to accommodate a wheelchair. The downstairs orthopedist's office had been the final, unignorable argument that this apartment should be theirs. They bought the flat. He had moved into it all the rugs and lamps and blankets that he had spent his working life accumulating and that had been packed in boxes in the Green Street basement. And before he returned to New York after the shoot ended, one of Malcolm's young, former associates who had moved back to London to work in Belcast's satellite office would begin renovating it. Oh, he thought, whenever he looked at the plans for Harley Street, it was so difficult. It was so sad sometimes, living in reality. He had been reminded of this the last time he had met with the architect, when he had asked Vikram why they weren't retaining the old wood-framed windows in the kitchen that overlooked the brick patio, with its views of the rooftops of Weymouth Mews beyond it. Shouldn't we keep them? He'd wondered. They're so beautiful.
They are beautiful, Vikram agreed. But these windows are actually very difficult to open from a sitting position. They demand a good amount of lift from the legs.
He realized then that Vikram had taken seriously what he had instructed him to do in their initial conversation, to assume that eventually one of the people who lived in the apartment might have a very limited range of motion.
Oh, he'd said, and had blinked his eyes rapidly.
Right. Thanks. Thanks.
Of course, Vikram had said. I promise you, Willem, it's going to feel like home for both of you.
He had a soft, gentle voice, and Willem had been unsure whether the sorrow he had felt in that moment was from the kindness of what Vikram said, or the kindness with which he said it. He remembers this now, back in New York. It is the end of July. He has convinced Jude to take a day off, and they have driven to their house upstate. For weeks, Jude had been tired and unusually weak, but then suddenly he hadn't been, and it was on days like this, the sky above them vivid with blue, the air hot and dry, the fields around their house buttery with clumps of yarrow and cowslip, the stones around the pool cool beneath his feet, Jude singing to himself in the kitchen as he made lemonade for Julia and Harold, who had come to stay with them, that Willem found himself slipping back into his old habit of pretending. On these days, he succumbed to a sort of enchantment, a state in which his life seemed both unimprovable and, paradoxically, perfectly fixable. Of course Jude wouldn't get worse.
Of course he could be repaired. Of course Willem would be the person to repair him. Of course this was possible. Of course this was probable. Days like this seemed to have no nights, and if there were no nights, there was no cutting. There was no sadness. There was nothing to dismay. You're dreaming of miracles, Willem, Idris would say if he knew what he was thinking, and he knew he was. But then again, he would think, what about his life? And about Jude's life, too. Wasn't it a miracle? He should have stayed in Wyoming. He should have been a ranch hand himself. Jude should have wound up, where? In prison? Or in a hospital? Or dead? Or worse? But they hadn't. Wasn't it a miracle that someone who was basically unexceptional could live a life in which he had made millions pretending to be other people? That in that life, that person would fly from city to city, would spend his days having his every need fulfilled, working in artificial contexts in which he was treated like the potentate of a small, corrupt country? Wasn't it a miracle to be adopted at 30? To find people who loved you so much that they wanted to call you their own? Wasn't it a miracle to have survived the unsurvivable? Wasn't friendship its own miracle? The finding of another person who made the entire lonely world seem somehow less lonely? Wasn't this house, this beauty, this comfort, this life a miracle? And so who could blame him for hoping for one more? For hoping that despite knowing better, that despite biology and time and history, that they would be the exception? That what happened to other people with Jude's sort of injury wouldn't happen to him? That even with all that Jude had overcome, he might overcome just one more thing? He is sitting by the pool and talking to Harold and Julia, when abruptly he feels that strange hollowing in his stomach that he occasionally experiences, even when he and Jude are in the same house, the sensation of missing him, an odd, sharp desire to see him. And although he would never say it to him, this is the way in which Jude reminds him of Hemming. That awareness that sometimes touches him as lightly as wings, that the people he loves are more temporal somehow than others, that he has borrowed them, and that someday they will be reclaimed from him. Don't go, he had told Hemming in their phone calls, back when Hemming was dying. Don't leave me, Hemming. Even though the nurses who were holding the receiver to Hemming's ear, hundreds of miles away, had instructed him to tell Hemming exactly the opposite. That it was all right for him to leave. That Willem was releasing him. But he couldn't. And he hadn't been able to either when Jude was in the hospital. So delirious from the drugs that his eyes had skittered back and forth with a rapidity that had frightened him almost more than anything else. Let me go, Willem, Jude had begged him then. Let me go. I can't, Jude, he had cried. I can't do that. Now he shakes his head to clear the memory. I'm going to go check on him, he tells Harold and Julia. But then he hears the glass door slide open, and all three of them turn and look up the sloping hill to see Jude holding a tray of drinks, and all three of them stand to go help him. But there is a moment before they begin heading uphill, and Jude begins walking toward them, in which they all hold their positions. And it reminds him of a set, in which every scene can be redone, every mistake can be corrected, every sorrow reshot. And in that moment, they are on one edge of the frame, and Jude is on the other. But they are all smiling at one another, and the world seems to hold nothing but sweetness. The last time in his life he would walk on his own, really walk, not just edging along the wall from one room to the next, not shuffling down the hallways of Rosen Pritchard, not inching his way through the lobby to the garage, sinking into the car seat with a groan of relief, had been their Christmas vacation. He was 46. They were in Bhutan. A good choice, he would later realize, for his final sustained spell of walking, although of course he hadn't known that at the time. because it was a country in which everyone walked. The people they met there, including an old acquaintance of theirs from college, Karma, who was now the Minister of Forestry, spoke of walking not in terms of kilometers, but in terms of hours.
"Oh, yes," Karma had said. "When my father was growing up, he used to walk 4 hours to visit his aunt on the weekends, and then he would walk 4 hours back home." He and Willem had marveled at this, although later they had also agreed. The countryside was so pretty, a series of swooping, treed parabolas, the sky above a thin, clear blue, that time spent walking here must move more quickly and pleasantly than time spent walking anywhere else. He hadn't felt at his best on that trip, although at least he was mobile. In the months before, he had been feeling weaker, but not in any truly specifiable way, not in any way that seemed to suggest some greater problem. He simply lost energy faster. He was achy instead of sore, a dull, constant thud of pain that followed him into sleep and was there to greet him when he woke. It was the difference, he told Andy, between a month speckled by thundershowers and a month in which it rained daily, not heavily but ceaselessly, a kind of dreary, enervating discomfort. In October, he'd had to use his wheelchair every day, which had been the most consecutive days he had ever been dependent on it. In November, although he had been well enough to make Thanksgiving dinner at Harold's, he had been in too much pain to actually sit at the table to eat it, and he had spent the evening in his bedroom, lying as still as he could, semi-aware of Harold and Willem and Julia coming in to check on him, semi-aware of his apologizing for ruining the holiday for them, semi-aware of the muted conversation among the three of them and Lawrence and Jillian, James and Carrie, that he half-heard coming from the dining room. After that, Willem had wanted to cancel their trip, but he had insisted, and he was glad he had, for he felt there was something restorative about the beauty of the landscape, about the cleanliness and quiet of the mountains, about getting to see Willem surrounded by streams and trees, which was always where he looked most comfortable. It was a good vacation, but by the end he was ready to leave. One of the reasons he had been able to convince Willem that they could go on this trip at all was because his friend Elijah, who now ran a hedge fund that he represented, was going on holiday to Nepal with his family, and they caught flights both from and back to New York on his plane. He had worried that Elijah might be in a talkative mood, but he hadn't been, and he had slept, gratefully, almost the entire way home, his feet and back blazing with pain. The day after they returned to Green Street, he couldn't lift himself out of bed. He was in such distress that his body seemed to be one long, exposed nerve, frayed at either end. He had the sense that if he were to be touched with a drop of water, his entire being would sizzle and hiss in response. He was rarely so exhausted, so sore that he couldn't even sit up, and he could tell that Willem, around whom he made a particular effort so he wouldn't worry, was alarmed, and he had to plead with him not to call Andy. "All right," Willem had said, reluctantly. "But if you're not better by tomorrow, I'm calling him." He nodded, and Willem sighed. "Damn it, Jude," he said. "I knew we shouldn't have gone." But the next day he was better. Better enough to get out of bed, at least. He couldn't walk. All day his legs and feet and back felt as if they were being driven through with iron bolts, but he made himself smile and talk and move about, though when Willem left the room or turned away from him, he could feel his face drooping with fatigue. And then that was how it was, and they both grew used to it. Although he now needed his wheelchair daily, he tried to walk every day for as much as he could, even if it was just to the bathroom, and he was careful about conserving his energy. When he was cooking, he made certain he had everything assembled on the counter in front of him before he started, so he wouldn't have to keep going back and forth to the refrigerator. He turned down invitations to dinners, parties, openings, fundraisers, telling Willem, that he had too much work to attend them, but really he came home and wheeled his way slowly across the apartment, the punishingly large apartment,
stopping to rest when he needed to, dozing in bed so he'd have enough life in him to talk to Willem.